This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Hey everyone, thanks for making time to come out tonight. I'd first like to congratulate Anthony, Luke, and the other organizers of this lecture series for really putting on a comprehensive series of talks bridging the fields of orthopedics and sports medicine. I also want to thank them for this opportunity to share some of my thoughts on the topics of what's new in arthritis and total joint replacement care. By way of introduction, my name is Eric Hansen. I recently rejoined the faculty here at UCSF, having done both medical school and residency here, and then doing some subspecialty training in Philadelphia with the Rothman Institute at Thomas Jefferson. So I have no financial disclosures relevant to this talk. I'm going to basically break down this talk into two halves. We'll start by reviewing our current understanding of osteoarthritis and the relevant non-operative treatment options for this disease. And then I'm going to delve into the techniques and technologies that really represent advances in total joint replacement. As an orthopedic surgeon, I often will slip into using jargon. So if I say something you don't quite understand or need a little bit more of an explanation, please just raise your hand. You're probably not alone. And just to get started, by a show of hands, how many of you know somebody who has hip or knee arthritis? And how many of you know somebody who has had a hip or knee replacement? Great. Looks like I chose the right specialty. To be honest, you know, I think this really underscores the fact that arthritis is probably one of the most common clinical conditions that affect adults, probably second only to hypertension or high blood pressure. And this really sort of underscores the relevance of this talk and the timeliness of it. So I'm going to just get started by dispelling four commonly held beliefs about osteoarthritis, and in so doing, I'm going to try to elucidate what we currently believe to be the mechanism for arthritis. So myth number one, osteoarthritis only affects older people. That's false. In fact, of three of the four of the patients I did total joint replacements on last week, they were all in their mid-50s. And I think this is also reflected in sort of what we're seeing on a national basis, and we know that this cohort is one of the fastest-growing demographics undergoing total joint replacement surgery. There's a lot of reasons why this may be the case. We know that we're in a national epidemic of obesity, but there's a concurrent trend towards fitness and an active lifestyle, and a lot of people just don't want to be bogged down with a painful joint when it's cramping their style for an otherwise active lifestyle. I do know that the patients that I'm currently seeing are fundamentally different from the patients that underwent total joint replacement several decades ago. Patients are healthier, they're younger, they're more active, they've got greater expectations and functional demands on the joint replacements themselves, and they're more informed, either via the internet or through direct-to-consumer marketing. Therefore, I would say that osteoarthritis affects everyone. If not us personally, then at least someone we know by one degree of separation. If you look at this graph in the upper right, this really shows the projected increase in the number of joint replacements in the coming decades. And by 2030, there's expected to be a doubling of total hip replacements, while there's going to be a nearly sevenfold increase in the number of total knee replacements. And therefore, as surgeons, we're really challenged with improving our techniques and our technologies to meet our patients' expectations to get back to the active lifestyles that they desire, whether that means surfing or yoga. Myth number two, osteoarthritis is caused by wear and tear. While it seems very logical to think that the more miles you put on the knee, the faster the cartilage is going to wear out, similar to the way if you drive a car, you're going to need to replace the tires sooner, we do know that the fundamental process of osteoarthritis is pathologic and is different from the age-related changes that happen to cartilage. If you imagine two 70-year-old women standing side by side, why does one develop arthritis and the other does not? And why does the person who did not develop arthritis more likely to have been the more active person throughout her life doing jogging and other aerobic exercises? It doesn't make sense if you just think of it as wear and tear. Even more perplexing is if I look at an x-ray of a patient, I see one hip that looks pristine and the other one looks completely worn out. That doesn't also make a whole lot of sense since you're walking symmetrically with both feet. But it does underscore the fact that arthritis is really a multifactorial disease. And there's clearly a genetic component, so people are predisposed to it. But it is affected by the exposures that you experience throughout life. So, for instance, a person who had a knee injury during high school playing sports may think it inconsequential for their early adult life, only to sort of revisit this 30 years later with advanced arthritis. So developments in sort of molecular biology has really helped us change our paradigm shift for osteoarthritis and conceptualizing it as an inflammatory disease. And one of the primary players in this is synovitis. So itis is always going to be inflammation. The synovium is the tissue in the knee, shown here as this red capsule-like tissue, and that's normally responsible for producing the lubrication fluid in your knee. But in response to seeing cartilage fragments from the arthritic process, this kind of revs it up to release inflammatory mediators. And these inflammatory mediators can damage the cartilage directly, but it will also sort of rev up the synovium to proliferate and grow bigger, and this becomes a vicious cycle. We also know that your body's innate immune system also plays a role, and they can the cells can detect different proteins in your synovial fluid or lubrication fluid as foreign bodies and react by producing, again, more inflammatory molecules. And finally, we know that it's not just a local inflammation, but that there's systemic inflammation that could be contributing to this disease process as well. Therefore, with all of these advances, we're seeing a thrust in looking for pharmacologic treatments that actually will modify the disease process and not simply mask the symptoms. Oftentimes, people are prescribed Tylenol or narcotics to deal with the pain, but not really medications that are going to alter these inflammatory disease pathways. Myth number three, obesity causes osteoarthritis due to overloading the joints. Again, a very simple and seemingly logical explanation. We do know that there is a direct relation between your body mass and the forces seen by your joint, such that if you can decrease your weight by 1 pound, you'll note a fourfold reduction in the forces across your joint. We also know that obese patients are at a 4 to 5 times a higher rate of developing knee arthritis. However, this theory does not account for the fact that hand arthritis is probably twice as common in people who are obese. And obviously, hands are non-weight-bearing appendages. So this is clearly not the whole picture. We're beginning to understand obesity in the context of what's called the metabolic syndrome. And the metabolic syndrome is really a constellation of medical problems that includes obesity, but also hypertension or high blood pressure, abnormalities with cholesterol, and insulin resistance or pre-diabetes. And we know now that this syndrome X is really a chronic low-grade inflammatory state. And therefore, some of the chemicals released by the adipose tissue or the fat tissue called adipokines are released into the systemic circulation, and they are inflammatory mediators, and a higher level of them have been associated with worsening destruction of cartilage. Therefore, really, weight loss should be seen not only as a preventive measure for developing diabetes and cardiovascular disease, but also osteoarthritis. Myth number four, osteoarthritis is all about cartilage. So articular cartilage is the cartilage that kind of covers the surface of our joints. It's a very complex structure. It is composed of cells, a matrix surrounding the cells, and predominantly water. And healthy cartilage looks like this pink substance up here, whereas osteoarthritis is defined as the progressive degeneration of cartilage seen here in a histologic slide. Unfortunately, we know that arthritis is progressive, and the reason that is because the cartilage cells or the chondrocytes really have limited repair capabilities in contrast to other tissues throughout our body. Therefore, once a process begins, the cartilage really can't heal itself like other parts of our body. Our present understanding is that the chondrocytes are still the primary players in the disease progression, but we're now appreciating other tissues within the knee joint, including the synovium, which I described earlier, the tissue that produces the lubrication fluid, but also the subchondral bone. So the subchondral bone is this layer of bone that's just deep to the cartilage. And we now know that the synovium and the subchondral bone all also produce these inflammatory mediators. So just to sort of summarize what I've discussed thus far, our prior concepts that osteoarthritis is a disease of cartilage due to wear and tear and mechanical overload has really shifted to understanding it as a systemic and local disease of inflammation that really affects multiple tissues throughout the joints. So now I'd like to review some current clinical practice guidelines on the non-operative treatment of osteoarthritis. So what are clinical practice guidelines? Well, they're evidence-based recommendations proposed by various organizations to address a clinical question. In this case, we're trying to determine what's appropriate and relevant treatment options for osteoarthritis. And what they do as a baseline is they review the existing literature for the highest quality studies, whether those are randomized controlled trials or systematic reviews and meta-analyses. The systematic reviews and meta-analyses are really studies where they aggregate the results from smaller studies to try to increase the power or statistical significance, which may not have been achieved in the smaller studies. These practice guidelines are often developed by various different organizations, and there may be discrepancies between the guidelines based on their interpretation of the data. There are many of them out there. I'm going to focus specifically on the following three. The AAOS stands for the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons. It's really our national organization that represents us. These guidelines were developed in conjunction with three other organizations, the College of Rheumatologists, Family Physicians, and the Physical Therapists. We'll also review the ACR, which is, again, the American College of Rheumatologists, who deal with inflammatory arthritides. And then there's the OARSI, which is the Osteoarthritis Research Symposium International, which in contrast to the others is actually a multinational, multidisciplinary group. Again, these consensus groups really are championed by physicians but incorporate the perspectives of other people involved in the treatment of arthritis, whether it be physical therapists, athletic trainers, and even the patients themselves. It's important to note that these clinical practice guidelines come out every several years, and especially there may be modifications due to a new study that came out, and so there are updates that happen not infrequently. For osteoarthritis, the majority of literature really is on knee osteoarthritis, and therefore a lot of what we take for hips is basically just translating that those results from one study to the other. So in regards to the clinical practice guidelines, the majority of them will address some, if not all, of these various treatment options, non-operative treatment options for arthritis. And I'm not going to go into painstaking detail about each one of the treatment options, but if you're interested in the subject, I would direct you to that website, which gives the AAOS guidelines, and I'm more than happy to provide electronic copies of the other clinical practice guidelines if you're interested. If there's one sort of take-home point from this section, it's this slide right here. Specifically, that self-management programs and low-impact aerobic exercise, as well as weight loss, are universally recommended by all of the clinical practice guidelines with strong research support for this. Basically, that both of these measures have demonstrated an improvement in pain and function for patients with osteoarthritis, and there really is no controversy about these two elements. It's really the other treatment options where there may be some controversy. Regarding weight loss, there's been a lot of studies published. But a few that I'll just highlight is one that basically shows that you can decrease your rate of developing symptomatic arthritis by 50% if you decrease your BMI, or your body mass index, by 2. For this patient group, a decrease in a body mass index of 2 was just over 10 pounds. to give you some sense of that magnitude. Other studies have shown that there's a dose-response relationship between change in body weight and your self-reported pain and functional status, with a threshold of 5 to 10% body weight. Furthermore, we know that combining diet with exercise will magnify the improvements in function and mobility. And there is a body of literature that looks specifically at weight loss surgery, whether it be gastric bypass, gastric banding, and its impact on osteoarthritis and pain. And in one study where patients lost a mean of 100 pounds, nearly 75% had complete resolution of their pre-existing knee pain at 1 year post-op. And now you know that it's not simply the fact that they have less weight across their joint, but there's probably an inflammatory component that has been resolved in the process of losing weight as well. Well, complementary and alternative medicine is nothing new for those of us in the Bay Area. It's actually quite a popular treatment modality, and acupuncture being probably the most popular of those. As you can see, the various organizations have different opinions about the utility of acupuncture in the treatment of arthritis. And although the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons do not recommend it for this particular indication, my personal bias and experience as a child who grew up in a household where traditional Chinese medicine and acupuncture was utilized quite frequently is that I think there is some therapeutic benefit from acupuncture. And I encourage my patients to encourage my patients to seek that out if that is something that they're interested in. Glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate are popular dietary supplements that have been marketed to support the structure and function of cartilage. At this point, there has been a number of very well-designed clinical trials that have basically determined that there's no clinical benefit of these supplements in changing or modifying the disease or improving pain. And therefore, basically all of the organizations do not recommend their use. Cortisone or steroid injections into a joint is basically the local administration of a very potent anti-inflammatory into the area where you want it delivered. It does have some mild systemic effects that when it leaks out into the bloodstream, but for the most part, it stays local within the knee joint. And I would say that this is probably the treatment that I recommend most frequently for patients with symptomatic arthritis, and we're not quite at the point of recommending surgery. Again, the majority of the organizations recommend this as an appropriate treatment. However, the Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, based on their interpretation of the data, toe the line a little bit more. Finally, the treatment that's probably received the most controversy in the past year is that of viscosupplementation or hyaluronic acid injections. What changed this past year is that the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons changed their stance on this treatment modality, basically saying that they do not recommend this as a treatment for arthritis. And their rationale behind this was that although there is literature to support some statistical significant benefits of the high molecular weight preparations of this injection, that statistical significance did not really translate into clinical significance. And therefore, based on that, they sort of changed their stance. And that's really impacted my practice because a lot of insurance companies no longer will cover these injections. At this point, I'm going to sort of stop there. That's basically the first half of the talk, reviewing kind of osteoarthritis, our current understanding, as well as some of the clinical practice guidelines that have come out recently. And I'm more than happy to answer any questions. In the red, in the back.
Do you ever discuss anti-inflammatory diets with your patients?
I don't, but you can see why the rationale makes sense. I am personally not expert in anti-inflammatory diets, but given what I said, I think you can understand that I believe that it will have therapeutic benefits, not only for osteoarthritis, but again, thinking about the metabolic syndrome as being a chronic inflammatory state with multiple ramifications. How about in the front?
Are there any supplements that are recommended?
So in terms of dietary supplements, there's such variability in what you get, and it's not FDA regulated since they're dietary supplements. There are no supplements that I specifically recommend to patients. I will tell them that there's probably not a lot of harm in them taking it, but I don't believe it's really providing any clinical benefit for their arthritis.
Do you make any distinctions about what type of weight is being carried? Like professional athletes might have a higher BMI. I mean, BMI itself is kind of...
Sure. So going back to that slide of the metabolic syndrome, you'll see that the weight is carried that we consider the central adiposity or central weight as compared to the sort of pear-shaped body. And so this is the type of fat that we consider to be more problematic.
So high BMI could be, for athletes, if they could have a high BMI and maybe not be subject to the same risk factors.
That's correct. I'm just going to go center, left, middle. In the back.
What is causing the inflammatory response within the knee joint?
So, again, so the synovium, there are multiple things, but the synovium is this tissue. It will see this cartilage debris as almost like foreign body or an irritant, and in response to that, rather than normally producing the lubrication fluid, it will start to ramp up its production of these inflammatory chemicals. And then, again, becomes sort of a cyclic process that those molecules will not only degrade the cartilage, but will start to make the synovium more hypertrophic or larger and then continue the process. I'm going to come over here. No, come over here.
It sounds like there might be factors in the blood that they can start to identify now as being associated with osteoarthritis.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think one of the things that we know is that osteoarthritis is a very heterogeneous group of probably related diseases, so it may not be the same in you as it is in me. But as I mentioned about, there are some that are associated with the fat tissue or the adipose tissue, and there are chemicals that are released from that have been seen and are more pronounced in patients with a more sort of destructive arthritis.
So you can start to separate out those types now. So you get it's heterogeneous, but now you can identify one kind maybe and get to another kind.
Right, and I think that really highlights the fact of sort of having targeted therapy rather than just doing symptomatic, oh, I'm going to take a narcotic to relieve the pain, trying to find out which mechanisms are at play in a given individual and then prescribing the appropriate pharmacologic treatments if that's...
Do you have any analog number of types?
No, I don't. But I mean, yeah.
Is there synovium in the hip also?
Yeah. Yeah, so there's synovium in any of the joints. And that, again, the function of that is to produce the lubrication fluid in the non-pathologic state. Pink.
Arthritis seems to cause bone spurs in some joints. Does that also happen in the knee?
Oh, very much so. So that would probably be another myth. I often think of it and describe it as having, friction because you've lost the cartilage, and so the biomechanical forces on that part of the knee are now abnormal, and so that might result in a bone scar, a osteophyte or a bone spur. But that's not truly the explanation, because you can have bone spurs develop in parts of the knee that don't seem to have as much cartilage wear. So again, that seems to indicate that there's something going on locally that is causing the bone to proliferate in an abnormal way that's not only mechanical. There is some biochemical, but we also know that cartilage cells have specific receptors on their surface that can respond to different pressures and basically change their internal workings based on that. So some of those mechanoreceptors may be the reason that chemicals are then released and cause those bone spurs to form.
So if you've got synovium in all your different joints, and stuff starts, presumably the synovium in each joint is acting differently. So is there some reason why, can you tell why the knee goes rather than the elbow?
No, I mean, I think in my experience, and you may have experienced this as well, is that someone who has knee arthritis commonly has arthritis involving other areas of their body. And that, again, sort of speaks to the genetic predisposition of certain individuals to develop arthritis. So although their synovial tissue, their synovial fluid is not contiguous or is not connected to the joint of the other ones, the sort of their cells have the same genetic imprint and are probably subject to the same issues.
It's going to the knee, it's going all over the place in all the other joints as well.
Well, again, they're separated in space because every joint is sort of encapsulated, right? And so the synovial fluid is not actually leaving the bloodstream and going and then going to the other joint, but the same tissue exists in each of the joints. The synovial tissue exists in the joints. And again, it's the genetic predisposition that probably then explains why a certain individual will develop arthritis in multiple joints more so than another.
I remember there was a lot of promise in the viscose supplementation because they thought that could replace the lubrication. Is there any continuing research in that area now if this is shown to be ineffective at this point?
I mean, interesting that you should bring that up. I mean, currently the radiology department in conjunction with the orthopedic department, me being one of the participants, is looking at viscosupplementation in the setting of very early arthritis to see if that will change the we call them proteoglycans, but some of the elements of the cartilage itself to potentially be a disease-modifying agent. But as I mentioned, I think you know this was a dramatic blow to the industry that of viscosupplementation with this new analysis of the data by the largest society of orthopedic surgeons. But to your point again, there is still research on the topic, but and that's why practice guidelines may change over time if additional data comes out. On the contrary, but currently the Academy's position is that they do not recommend the viscosupplementation injections. But, you know, in my practice, Medicare still pays for viscosupplementation injections, and I'm sure that it will change over time, but they're probably the only group that does not need to have any pre-authorization to get the viscosupplementation injections. There are fairly strict criteria, though. You can't have full bone-on-bone changes in the joint. Because, I mean, again, you sort of are using this treatment as an alternative to cortisone injections in the mild to moderate arthritis. When it becomes severe arthritis, then the outcomes are less predictable. And so I often will not utilize it because it doesn't have as strong an anti-inflammatory component as a cortisone.
Do you have any experience with people who have arthritis as caused by Lyme disease, and does it have a different progression from osteoarthritis caused by joint?
Yeah, so I think any of the infectious diseases that cause arthritides are a different bird than the osteoarthritis. Is a different bird from the inflammatory arthritis associated with rheumatoid disease. Is different from post-traumatic arthritis. So I think again. We're sort of very early in our understanding of how these all overlap, but sort of the end result is the you know destruction of cartilage. But how we get there and the individual molecular pathways that resulted in this final sort of clinical presentation are probably quite distinct. Yellow in the back.
Is there a recommended limit to the number of cortisone shots for a particular joint?
So cortisone injections, again, they're potent steroids, and steroids have a number of different intended and unintended consequences. And therefore, you do have to sort of weigh the risks and benefits of multiple cortisone injections. Each surgeon has each surgeon or each practitioner has a different comfort level at when the risks may outweigh the benefits. Risks of cortisone or repeated cortisone injections are, for one, it can sort of decrease or the local immune system, so you may be predisposed to infection, especially in the setting of a prior infection in the joint. It also has been shown to be deleterious to the surrounding soft tissues if done too frequently. And for that reason, my personal practice is to space them out at a minimum of 6 months. But I do know people who will bring that shorter to about every 4 months. Again, I think if you're requiring the cortisone injections on a very, very frequent basis, then you have to start thinking about a more definitive solution to that because it's not a long-lasting solution. And we do know that there are diminishing returns from subsequent injections. So although the first injection, you might get a lot of bang for your buck, the subsequent ones may be progressively less and less. And so 6 months has been sort of my sort of standard, not based on specific literature, but just that it allows the body to kind of flush it out, and then you can get a re-bolus of the medication, hopefully have the same therapeutic benefit. In the front.
Can you comment on any research that's now being done for cartilage replacement?
No, not specifically. I'm not sure if one of the other lecturers is going to talk specifically about cartilage biology. I'm not an expert in cartilage biology, but I do, you know, eventually think that that's the way that we're going to go in the future and probably work myself out of a job so that we're not replacing joints with metal and plastic and actually using biologic materials, which makes a lot more sense to do. But no, specifically, I can't lead you down that path. I'll go blue in the back.
Is there, so you can only do the cortisone every 4 to 6 months, and you do weight reduction, you do as, you know, as well as you can. Is there any other way of treating this inflammatory state that seems to be a vicious and create this, spontaneously starts this cycle that will progressively degenerate?
Yeah. I mean, someone brought up the anti-inflammatory diet. Again, I don't have experience with that, but thinking about ways of decreasing the systemic inflammation makes a lot of sense to me. Obviously, you don't want someone taking, you know, an anti-inflammatory daily for the rest of their life because, again, there are side effects with that, specifically, you know, the gastrointestinal tract with ulcers and just stomach upset as well as the kidneys. So although anti-inflammatories are very effective, oral anti-inflammatories, whether they be ibuprofen, Motrin, Aleve / Naprosyn, or others, those can decrease your systemic inflammation. Again, I think the most important things are modifying diet, having a exercise regimen with the goal of decreasing weight. And those processes are probably the most important. And for people, because often I'm caught or I'm approached by a patient who claims to be in a catch-22, right? Because the knee hurts, you can't exercise, you can't burn calories, and so you gain weight. And so it's challenging. But for people who have access to a pool, where you can kind of offload the joint and still do some type of aerobic activity, that's the ideal scenario. But there's really not too many good solutions. And now we're going to switch gears and talk about surgery. So what's new in total joint replacement? So before going into the novel techniques and technologies that we use for total joint replacement, it's good to sort of review what the fundamental goals of the operation are. And specifically for patients with advanced arthritis who failed the non-operative treatments we've already discussed, the goals are threefold. Number one, you want to decrease pain and maximize the patient's function. Number two, you want to recreate normal anatomy. And by so doing, you establish the biomechanics of the joint. And this requires that you put in appropriately sized, aligned, and positioned implants. And finally, you want to create a durable reconstruction that will hopefully last the patient several decades long. And this really is a marriage between material science and mechanical engineering. So before we go into the advances in total joint replacement, I just wanted to start with a primer on hip and knee replacement so we're all sort of speaking the same terminology. So a total hip replacement is basically comprised of four parts. You have the acetabular component, or otherwise known as the socket shell or cup, and this is made of metal. It can be titanium or cobalt chrome, but it's usually made of metal. And oftentimes, it has a porous or a rough sandpaper finish on it, and that allows the bone to kind of grow into the metal to create this biologic fix between the two. into the shell, we then put a liner. It can be two different flavors, hard or soft. The hard flavor would be either a metal, again, cobalt chrome, or a ceramic. And the soft variation is polyethylene or medical grade plastic. The third component is the femoral head or the ball. And that, again, is going to be a hard material. It's going to be either cobalt chrome or ceramic. And the reason it's not titanium is that titanium is too soft a metal. And therefore, if it developed any scratches, you can imagine that that is going to really abrade the plastic. So it needs to be a very hard metal, which cobalt chrome is. And finally, we have the femoral component or the stem. And again, this is made of different types of metal, but titanium is quite often the one that we utilize because its mechanical properties are quite good for not only getting bone to grow into it, but also the contrast between the titanium and the native bone is not as marked as a heavier metals. In the United States, we use primarily cementless fixation. Cementless, again, indicates that the bone has to grow into the implant for that to be a stable construct, whereas in Europe, oftentimes they'll do what are called cemented total joints, and there they're going to use medical-grade cement to kind of use it as grout to fix the implants to the bone. In terms of what we're aiming for, in terms of our position in surgery, we want the cups to be about 45 degrees of abduction or lateral opening and about 15 degrees in anaversion or forward facing. And the idea is that most of our activities of daily living are in the frontal plane, so that when you flick, you're more often to be flexing your hip up than you are to be kicking your hip back. And so you want your sockets to be face forward because it'll be less likely to impinge in that position. For the stem, we want to obviously match the patient's anatomic size, and the stem also has a degree of version so that there's a rotation in the frontal plane. In total knee replacement, we think of the knee as being comprised of three parts or three compartments. There's the medial compartment or the inner compartment, there's the lateral or the outer compartment, and then there's the patellofemoral or the anterior compartment. Patellofemoral is the kneecap compartment. So if your arthritis only affected primarily the medial compartment, then you might have an indication for doing what's called a partial knee replacement. But if there are changes in other parts of the knee, a total knee replacement is a preferred surgical option. Like the total hip, it's made of four components. The femoral component is cobalt chrome, again, because it needs to be a very hard metal that is not prone to scratches. The tibial component is titanium because, again, it has a better mechanical properties. And then the tibial liner or the insert is made of polyethylene or the medical-grade plastic. And there's also a button that's placed on the backside of the patient's native kneecap, which, again, is plastic and allows it to kind of flex and extend over the knee replacement. In contrast to the total hips, the vast majority of our knee replacements are cemented rather than cementless, although there are some surgeons who will do cementless designs. And in terms of the way that we're trying to position our components, we want the joint line, or we want the mechanical weight-bearing axis to go right through the center of the knee. That'll sort of ensure that the loads are evenly distributed on the knee. And we want the joint line, or this horizontal line, to be perpendicular to this mechanical weight-bearing axis. And that, again, ensures that all the forces are compressive, which is what you want. You don't want them to be shear, because then you can have movement of the implant in early failure. For the sizing of the components, we want to kind of match the patient's native anatomy. You can see here on this front x-ray or anterior-posterior x-ray that the tibial component looks to be about appropriately sized for the patient's bone. And then here on the lateral or the side x-ray, you can kind of see, again, us trying to match the size of the patient's anatomy. So now we'll go on to some of the recent advancements in total joint replacement. And we'll start with the first goal, that of decreasing pain and maximizing function. So this concept of a perioperative pathway has really been championed as a way to improve the patient's experience with total joint replacement surgery, as well as improve their clinical outcomes. It's a patient-centered, multidisciplinary approach that includes not only the surgeon, but the anesthesia team, the physical therapy team, the pharmacist, nursing, as well as the social workers. And very important to this is the preoperative education class, because this helps to manage patient expectations, as well as give them a heads up about what to expect, not only about the surgery itself, but about their hospital stay and the early recovery. Really, I think the success of joint replacement really has to do with meeting the expectations of the patient. So if they told me that I want to get this knee replacement because I want to get back into mixed martial arts, and then I tell them afterwards that they shouldn't participate in mixed martial arts, then I've really done a disservice to the patient by having them undergo a surgery, which is not going to necessarily allow them to do what they want to do. Another very important component of this perioperative pathway is what's called a multimodal pain and antiemetic protocol. In the past, we often use general anesthesia, we use intravenous narcotics, and those had very significant side effects on the patients. So now what we do, I'd say in over 95% of our patients, is we use spinal anesthesia. So similar to an epidural in childbirth, you numb up the waist down, and then you give patients medication so they're asleep, but they're breathing spontaneously. So they don't have a breathing tube, and they're able to kind of wake up from surgery very smoothly. They have a lot less nausea and vomiting. Their pain is incredibly well controlled. And as a result of having less opioid use, you have less of those side effects as well, the constipation, the lightheadedness, and et cetera, and confusion. Also, we've sort of undertaken a very aggressive protocol in terms of physical therapy, such that we try to get patients up the day of surgery. So oftentimes patients are starting to walk later in the day after having just had received their hip replacement. And this is very different from before, where we would have people lying in bed for days at a time. We really encourage them to mobilize early. And that, again, minimizes the complications that came with being in a recumbent position for a long time, such as bed sores and blood clots, et cetera. And I'd say that of any of the technologies that I'm going to discuss, or techniques or technologies that I'm going to discuss today, this single introduction of perioperative pathways has probably revolutionized the outcomes for patients. The other topic I want to talk about in this section are surgical approaches to the knee and the hip, focusing on the term minimally invasive. This term minimally invasive is used quite often, but it's not well defined. And despite that, a lot of surgeons will utilize it because it sort of it plays to a patient's desire for obviously smaller incisions, decreased pain, and early functional recovery. But minimally invasive in the knee may mean a number of different things. It can actually refer to the absolute length of the incision. So you can see here in the top picture, the minimally invasive incision versus the traditional incision. It may refer to the fact that you're going into the quadriceps tendon. Here in this diagram below, the red line is our standard approach to the knee after we've cut through the skin. So that is leaving a cuff of the quadriceps tendon going around the patella or kneecap and then going into the patellar tendon. The blue and the green are what are considered minimally invasive approaches because you don't go into the quadriceps tendon. And there are some studies that have shown that there may be a small benefit in extension strength or straightening out your knee at the early time points. Minimally invasive may mean how you deal with the patella or the kneecap during your exposure of the joint replacement. Oftentimes what we do to look at the bones, obviously because the kneecap's right in the middle, is we have to take it and flip it backwards and push it out of the way. But there are other ways to get to it by just slightly shifting it to the side. The issue with the minimally invasive approaches is that you're operating through a very limited window, so your exposure is much less, and the potential for putting your parts in not ideally is higher as well. And this really is important during the learning curve of surgeons adopting this technique. In a meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials comparing minimally invasive versus the traditional approaches, there's really no significant difference in clinical or radiographic parameters other than a small improvement in flexion range of motion. It's also important to realize that it's not for everyone. You can't do a minimally invasive approach on an obese patient or a patient with a big-time deformity in their knee. It really is sort of for the bread-and-butter cases. Now moving on to the surgical approaches of the hip. The direct anterior approach to total hip replacement has really sort of been in vogue, I'd say, in the last couple years, but it's nothing new. In fact, it was described a century ago by this surgeon, Dr. Smith Peterson, and only recently has sort of had a rebirth, again, because of people's fascination with quote-unquote minimally invasive surgery. It is, in fact, the only intermuscular and internervous approach, which means that you're going between muscles and between nerves. And therefore, nothing needs to be cut. I think I refer to it as basically opening up the curtains, doing the surgery, and then closing the curtains. Whereas with the other approaches, you always have to cut through some muscles or through tendons. However, this approach requires not only specialized training, as a lot of residency programs don't currently teach residents this, but it also requires special instrumentation and oftentimes a special table, as shown here, to do the operation. There's now a fairly robust body of literature that show that there are, in fact, early improvements in functional outcomes with the direct anterior approach, as well as less muscle damage based on postoperative imaging studies and analysis of biomarkers after surgery. However, it's important to realize that these studies are performed by the experts who basically have popularized this technique, and this may not reflect the experience of the community surgeon who is just beginning to learn this approach and try it on patients. Also, temporizing this enthusiasm is a novel set of complications not seen in the other approaches, including damage to the what's called the lateral femorocutaneous nerve, which causes numbness in the front of your thigh. There's a higher chance of putting the parts in wrong again because of a more limited exposure. And we do know that there's a very steep learning curve before a surgeon is adept at this technique. Moreover, if a surgery has to be redone, it's not extendable like the other approaches. The window, the anatomic window, is fairly small. You can see it almost right here. And because of the limits of the window that you're operating it through, you can't extend it indefinitely. Whereas in the other approaches, because you're kind of cutting through muscles, you can actually extend it for as much as you need to get the operation done. Now we'll move on to the second goal, which is recreating the normal anatomy. Again, you think of it like trying to restore the biomechanics of the hip and optimizing your component position to basically reproduce what the patient started with. So on the hip side, there was an introduction of what are called modular femoral stems. And they were developed in an attempt to recreate the patient's femoral anatomy, their hip anatomy. You can see them right here. And basically, modularity refers to the fact that you can interchange different stems with different necks. So the necks have different lengths, they have different angles, and you really are trying to copy what the patient has in terms of their bony anatomy. If you look at the x-rays on the top, you'll see that the x-rays look very different, or at least fairly different in terms of the angle of the head to the shaft of the femur. And therefore, if you put a standard implant in both patients, you would imagine it's going to fit well in one patient and not fit well in the other, or else it's going to fit so-so in both patients. But if you had this modularity, you could potentially fine-tune your reconstruction to recreate the bone that you had resected. This was a technology that was adopted by the real experts in the field, again, because they wanted to really fine-tune their reconstruction. Unfortunately, the novel set of complications came out, leading to a number of recalls. You can imagine that there's a stress riser that exists where you put this little stem into the neck, and that's the weak point. And therefore, there was descriptions of this actually breaking in patients. Also, there's some motion between the neck and the stem, although on the microscopic level, this caused corrosion, and some problems with what we call the metal-on-metal reaction was also seen here. Therefore, the majority of these types of implants have recently been recalled. Again, thinking that we had a great idea, but then once they're introduced into patients, sort of seeing some unforeseen consequences. In the world of total knees, a similarity sort of occurred. Surgeons and implants recognized that not everyone's bone was the same. males and females were distinct in that females tended to have sort of thinner distal femurs than men for a given sort of size of an implant. Therefore, if you put a standard total knee implant into a woman, it may overhang the sides of her bone, causing soft tissue irritation. In response to that, one of the companies developed what they called the gender-specific knee. So there's the blue and the red, or blue and the pink. And then many other companies sort of took that idea and ran with it. And now all have some variation where they're trying to improve the fit of their components. So the analogy is buying a shoe. Most times you go to a shoe store, you can buy a 9, a 9.5, a 10. And there are some companies that give you, like New Balance, where you can get a wide or a standard shoe. Well, now what we're dealing with is you've got a 9, a 9.25, a 9.5, 9.75, and a 10. Whether or not this fine-tuning of the sizes to that degree makes any clinical difference is still to be seen. But there have been some randomized controlled trials in women where they've done bilateral knee replacements, one side gender-specific, one side standard. And there really is no difference. The patients can't even tell which one is the gender-specific or the standard one. And no difference in range of motion or in their gait. The next technology I'd like to talk about is what's called patient-specific instrumentation, or otherwise known as custom cutting blocks. So this technology was introduced to better fit and position our knee implants. You start with a preoperative CT or MRI, which then gives you a 3D rendering of the patient's own knee. Then you input it into this computer program, and with software, you're able to put virtual implants onto that patient's knee. And you can decide exactly where you want to put it on the bone, what size you want to do, make sure it's fitting appropriately, it's aligned appropriately. Once the surgeon's happy with the plan, submits it to the manufacturer then creates these custom cutting blocks, which are shown down here. And those cutting blocks basically are then affixed to the patient's bone during surgery, and there are slots in there that allow for the saw cuts to be made to kind of reproduce that virtual knee that you had already planned. It is important to point out that although these cutting blocks are customized to the patient, the actual implants are the same. So you may have planned for a size 4 knee from your computer program, and you'll just use the standard 4 knee. It's not like you're getting a customized knee replacement. You're just preoperatively planning and knowing what size you're going to use in surgery and sort of determining where you want to make your bone cuts to create the sort of best alignment. There have been a lot of studies, and the proponents of this technology will say that their alignment is better than standard instrumentation, but there are also studies that would argue the opposite. Others, proponents of this will say that you can actually cut costs by decreasing your surgical time and the processing time of all the sterilized instruments, but the most would agree that the increased cost of the preoperative MRI and the cutting blocks negate any of those cost savings. So these are sort of falling out of favor, but there was a real sort of boon, I'd say, within the past year of these cutting blocks. And the last technology that I'll talk about in the field of trying to recreate anatomy is the idea of introducing robotics into the operating room. So this sort of came about by trying to minimize the human technical error in any given surgery. And robotics, obviously, are very precise for that. And so that's why it was thought that they could improve our sort of cuts for hip and knee replacement. However, these robots are quite expensive, and they require a very large initial investment by the hospital, and therefore they're very limited in their distribution throughout the country. And there are only a few centers here in California which will have a robot. Again, like the previous technology, it uses a preoperative CT scan to create a 3D image of the patient's knee, where the surgeon will then plan the appropriate sizing and position of their implants. This is an image of a partial knee replacement. So the green is the area that the surgeon wants to remove from the bone to put the partial knee replacement. The surgeon then has a handheld device. In this case, it's a burr that'll allow him or her to kind of burr the bone down in this green area. But the crux of this technology is what's called haptics, which is this tactile feedback that basically, once the surgeon is putting this robot hand onto the patient's bone, the robot will give you tactile feedback of where to stop, where the green line, you've actually hit the green line. It will not let you go outside of your planned resection. So in that sense, it's much more accurate and sort of quote-unquote foolproof. A lot of the research has been done by the surgeon innovators of this technology, so it kind of has to be seen in that light. They have shown that they're able to put their components in better alignment than standard instrumentation, but this is not equated to any difference in clinical outcomes. So whether or not this robotics is the future of hip and knee replacement or is just a passing fad, I think really has to do with whether or not we can make these robots more user-friendly and more economic. Finally, the final goal of the total joint replacement is creating a durable reconstruction. Again, you'd like for this joint replacement to last 20 to 30 years so the patient doesn't need to have to come back for a redo operation. I mentioned earlier that the majority of our metals that we use in hip and knee replacement are titanium. However, in the past 5 to 10 years, a whole group of what we call highly porous metals have been developed. One of the companies has named it trabecular metal. Trabecula is the structure you see here. That's kind of the cancellous bone or the bone marrow bone. And you can see how similar this looks to kind of that bone marrow. And this is actually the metal itself. And this really optimizes bone ingrowth. You can imagine that the bone can kind of interlock into these pores within the bone. In the sort of bone loss setting of a revision surgery, these types of highly porous metals have shown to be quite superior to the standard titanium because of their mechanical properties, but they come at a much higher price point. So whether or not these highly porous metals actually start being used in our primary joint replacements still remains to be seen. The polyethylene, again, is the medical grade plastic that's the liner for both the hip and the knee. The problem in the past is that the plastics we were using prior to 2000 had very poor wear properties. And so as the ball was kind of rubbing on the plastic, it was causing the plastic particles to shed. And the cells within the knee joint would kind of try to engulf those plastic particles to get rid of them. And in so doing, they would release some enzymes that would degrade, sort of friendly fire, the tissues around the hip joint. And so that would often cause the bone to become destroyed and eventually have the implants fail. But there have been multiple iterations in the manufacturing process of the plastics over time, to the point we now have something called highly cross-linked polyethylene, which has incredible wear properties. And there are clinical studies that are now 10 to 15 years out that looking at the x-rays have shown no wear of the plastic or evidence of this process called osteolysis where the bone is dissolving. However, everything has sort of a converse. Although the wear properties are improved with this, the mechanical properties are inversely related to the wear properties. So although it's very resistant to wear abrasion, it is more brittle. And therefore, there is the potential for this plastic to actually fracture. Despite that, it is considered our current gold standard with which all other bearing surfaces are compared. Ceramic was the other bearing that I described. Ceramics have even lower wear rates than polyethylene, and therefore they've been sort of recommended for people who are younger and more active. However, they have their own unique complications, such as audible squeaking. That was an issue that people may have seen on YouTube or heard in the news where people are walking around and you actually hear their hip moving. And unlike some of the other bearings, they have the potential for catastrophic fracture since they're a very brittle but hard material. As a response to some of these idiosyncratic complications, a new ceramic entered the market. It's called a Delta ceramic, and it is a composite of the prior ceramics that tries to minimize these risks. There was an investigational drug test using these new ceramics, and although the squeaking issue seemed to be resolved, there were still some the times when the liner fractured. So clearly, the jury is still out on this new ceramic. And finally, the metal-on-metal bearing was something that was very, very popular, I'd say, in the last decade, chosen for the younger, more active patients. And if we look back at the registry data, between 2005 and 2006, nearly one-third of all hip replacements were metal-on-metal. And this accounted for nearly 500,000 patients in the U.S. total. However, there was an alarming rate of early failures seen in the registry data with these metal-on-metal bearings that were attributable to particular devices as well as component malposition. Initially, our thought was that it was due to the fact that the metal ball was wearing on the metal liner and causing these ions to leak out. Now we know that the metal-on-metal reaction can happen wherever there are two metal interfaces. So I described this modular stem, and again, there's metal-on-metal contact there and potential for motion at that interface, and even the metal ball sitting onto the metal stem at that neck trunnion can also have corrosion. So now we're realizing that the metal-on-metal phenomenon is a much larger problem than initially thought. And because of this this epidemic, we've learned a lot about the metal-on-metal reaction, and it really represents a constellation of pathologic findings. The umbrella term is ARMD, or an adverse reaction to metal debris, and it may manifest intraoperatively like this very gray, ugly staining of tissue called metallosis. It may present as what's called a pseudotumor, or in this MRI down here, you see this big, large, cystic fluid mass that's destroying the muscles around the hip. But at its core, they histologically, they represent the same thing, which is this type 4 hypersensitivity reaction. And based on our current literature, there are certain recommendations we have for patients with metal-on-metal hips, and that is to obtain baseline serum cobalt and chromium levels. Again, we discussed that cobalt chrome is the common metal used for heads, and that there is an upper threshold that we consider acceptable, which is 7 parts per billion. If patients' metal ions are markedly elevated above that, or if they're having any symptoms, groin pain, sort of a new onset limp, then we'll obtain cross-sectional imaging. That'll either be this, which is a metal subtraction MRI, or we'll get an ultrasound to look for this pseudotumor or this fluid collection. And then we recommend revision if there's any evidence of soft tissue damage, if there are markedly elevated ion levels in a malpositioned or a recalled component. So I think, having now described several of what we call the recent advances in total joint replacement, it really is important if we sort of look where we started and to honestly ask ourselves how far have we really come. This is Sir John Charnley. He's considered the forefather of the modern hip replacement, and this is his low-friction arthroplasty. It was a cemented stainless steel one-piece stem with a cemented plastic liner. And even compared to today's standards, his results were very impressive. He had survivorship of his joint replacements upwards of 90% at 20 years. And compared to what we're currently seeing in the media with implant companies recalling what they considered their next greatest device and the numerous sort of lawyers ads for class action lawsuits, I think if we're honest with ourselves, we haven't come that far. And it's not that the surgeons or the implant companies purposely wanted to hurt anyone in their development of these technologies. Really, they're trying to utilize the advances in technologies to achieve our three fundamental goals. The problem is that people adopted the technologies and techniques prior to having very rigorous research on them, and therefore we only found out about their clinical ramifications after they had already been implanted in patients for a period of time. So in conclusion, I'll say that, again, I believe total joint replacement is a very successful operation for advanced arthritis not responding to the conservative measures. And our goals, our threefold goals of surgery haven't changed. Again, decrease pain, maximize function, recreate anatomy, and create a durable reconstruction. But we're applying novel technologies to achieve them. And apart from those perioperative pathways I described, as well as some of the material advances in the cross-linked polyethylene and the highly porous metals, I really believe we've made very few true advances in the field over the past decade. And as this recent metal-on-metal epidemic has shown us, the responsible adoption of novel techniques and technologies is imperative. So thank you. And with that, I'll start addressing questions about this topic. And left.
So one procedure you didn't talk about was in the hip and resurfacing. Uh-huh. And I don't know if you have a point of view on it or how you think about it. And then related to that, just more thoughts on the Medline now.
Yeah, so I mean, hip resurfacing was, again, this was a surgical technique and implant that was thought to be appropriate for younger, more active patients because it is bone conserving. So in contrast to the picture of, you know, my classic hip replacement where you have this stem that kind of goes down, goes all the way down the shaft of the femur, you're basically putting a cap on the neck of the femur. And the thought was that you would basically be, you know, causing less bone damage. The problem with the hip resurfacing is that all of them are inherently going to be a metal-on-metal hip replacement. Because that is sort of the design of the hip resurfacing. You put a metal cap and you put a metal socket and you maximize the head size, and that is very good for stability purposes. But if you are not expert and you don't put your parts in exactly right, if there's any malposition, you can cause excessive wear of that metal cup and have all of the problems we discussed regarding metal-on-metal reactions. And therefore, the majority of people have shied away from that procedure. My boss, Dr. Vail, has still done that procedure, but he's an expert at that and has also uses computer navigation to help position his implants exactly where he wants them. But for the majority of people, there's just been such a concern with metal on metal and unintended consequences of metal ion levels that people have shied away from that. In the middle? Sure.
Are they using 3D printers at all to try to create what kind of knee replacement or something that you want to do? Is that getting involved in the technology?
Well, there are actual custom implants. So I talked about custom cutting blocks where you make your cuts but you use the off-the-shelf implants. There are custom implants. They don't. They're not currently using 3D printing to do that, but they do. They will take a preoperative three-dimensional scan to then determine how they're going to build those implants. But again, if you see the way healthcare is going, we're trying to cut costs and minimize the outliers. And a technology like that is going to be the first one on the chopping block, because unless you prove that there is a significant benefit from making a shoe for just your foot compared to just taking a size 9 shoe off the shelf, then, I mean, it's going to be a hard sell.
If someone needs to get a joint replacement, it seems like the surgeon's experience is very important. How many surgeries does someone have to perform until you consider them sufficiently experienced?
Excellent question. I don't know if there's an absolute number, but again, this learning curve when you adopt a new technique is probably about 100 cases. And usually the way it goes, if you're not exposed to it during your residency training, is you do what's called a cadaver course, or you do several cadaver courses where you're operating with the surgeon innovators of the technique. And then you will either visit them in the operating room and actually see them do it on a live person. And then maybe for your first cases, you actually fly them out to cooperate with you until you feel like you have the technique down. But there's always going to be a learning curve when you adopt a new technique. And, you know, I've always been told by people who have come before me that the operation I do in 10 years is probably going to be very different from the operation I'm doing now. And so it's inevitable that we're going to have to adopt new techniques and technologies over time. We just can't be doing the same things that we always did in the past. We've got to be malleable, and so you just have to do it responsibly. In the blue?
Is there a defining issue in terms of when you do it, and in the case of how advanced, is it advanced enough that it could be replaced and not so advanced that there would be problems?
Are you talking about the arthritis is too advanced?
Yeah.
So I will always let the patient sort of tell me when they're ready for joint replacement. Oftentimes in the hip, it's at the state where they cannot sleep at night because they can't find a comfortable position, and so they're constantly tired throughout the day and every step is painful. But in terms of an X-ray appearance of arthritis, that sort of is a criteria. That's never going to be a criteria because some patients will have terrible-looking X-rays, and they're actually doing quite well and very functional. And there are people who have more mild X-rays and are disabled by it. So the only time to recommend surgery, potentially before the patient is theoretically ready, is when their arthritis is causing such bone loss that the joint replacement is going to be compromised if we let it go too far, or if they have such severe deformities. So people develop contractures around their hips and knees that will compromise the success of the joint replacement. Then I will say, you know, if we let this go too far and your knee keeps on bending like this, the ligaments are going to get so stretched out that we can't do our simple knee replacement. We have to do a much more complex knee replacement. And so I don't want it to get to the point where you've lost the integrity of your ligaments or lost so much bone that now we have to do almost a redo knee replacement when we could have done a more primary type knee replacement. In the yellow?
I have a two-part question. I've heard people say, you know, gosh, I wish I'd done my hip replacement 10 years earlier. You know, I waited too long and now it feels great. The recovery wasn't so bad. And I've heard people who've had knees replaced say, wow, it was so painful. The recovery was so hard. You should wait, you know, until the procedures are better or the replacement. Is there any truth to that, or is that just an anecdote?
There's absolute truth to that. A hip replacement is a much easier recovery than a knee replacement. Because the sort of post-operative rehabilitation is not as painful. So for a knee, as soon as you put the knee replacement in, people are going to start to develop scar tissue in their knee. And so you want to make sure that they're aggressively bending it and working on range of motion exercises from the get-go. And if you don't get that range of motion within a prescribed period of time, say 6 weeks, then the scar tissue gets so dense that you either have to manipulate it in surgery or they're left with a functional limitation. And so the pain limits your desire to bend your knee. And you have to fight through pain to get that range of motion. With the hip, it's not so much an issue with doing physical therapy. Really, the most important therapy after hip replacement is just gentle walking. You don't have to be doing a lot of strengthening or pushing it as far as you do with a knee replacement. And I think there's some element of the soft tissue envelope around the joint. So you've got a lot of more cushion around your hip, and that kind of is protective in a sense, whereas the knee is very vulnerable. It's very exposed. You make all those bone cuts right there, and it just doesn't have that sort of protective encasing around it. But that being said, I have noticed a dramatic difference in the recovery of patients from when I started residency to now. The pain that I discussed, the pain management protocols with these perioperative pathways have revolutionized patients' experience after surgery. The spinals, we do spinals, but we also do nerve catheters where it kind of numbs up the leg for the first 24 to 36 hours. People are, you know, relatively pain-free. Pain levels of 2 or 3, you know, during their hospital stay. In contrast to when I first started residency, people were on IV narcotics. They were, you know, completely confused. They were either asleep or they're in excruciating pain. So I think that those pathways have really improved the experience. But in general, again, the hip replacement is a much easier recovery. And it is very often that they will say, I wish I had done this 2 years prior.
And then just connected, you hear about people who need to have both knees replaced. Mm-hmm. Is it a totally individual decision, or do you recommend they be both done at once or sequentially?
So you have to look at a number of certain factors. One of them is the patient's age and their comorbidities, because the stress of doing both at the same time is significant, and there's an increased risk of cardiac complications, increased risk of death. There's an increased risk of blood transfusions doing both simultaneously. Currently, we rarely transfuse a patient if they do a single joint replacement, but there is a higher rate of getting a blood transfusion. So if you're very averse to that, then I would opt out of doing both simultaneously. Also, you likely will end up in a skilled nursing facility or rehab facility after a double knee replacement, in contrast to being able to go home after a single. And so that makes a big difference for certain people. However, there are certain patients that you really do have to do both at the same time. And those are people who have such severe contractures of both joints that if you only replace one, the patient had really bad angles of their knees and you straightened out one, but they still have this crook in their other side. They can't recover or rehabilitate when they're still limited on the other side. And usually what happens is the new side will sort of revert back to the old side of developing a contracture, et cetera, just so that it allows them to walk and do things. So for people with bad hip and knee contractures, oftentimes we'll have to do both simultaneously so they can have a symmetric rehab. And then the other factor that plays into it, as I mentioned, people are younger. People are getting joint replacements younger, so they're working. And to take time off of work for two separate joint replacements may not be possible. And so they say, I need to get back to work at a certain time, and doing them simultaneously will enable them to sort of get back into the workforce quicker.
Is it a prudent approach, Sam, from what you said, to have an orthopedic review of your knee joints to factor that in your judgment process as to whether replacement is something to do now or later, even though you may not be presenting your pain or mobility issues?
Mm-hmm. Well, to that I would say that if a patient is noticing that they're having sort of severe, we call it deformity or angulation or contractures of their knee, then it's probably prudent to have that evaluated, because that's probably just going to worsen over time. Think of it like the Leaning Tower of Pisa. Once the knee starts to angle a certain point, then the gravity is going to force it to angle more and more and more. It's not going to straighten out. And so they should probably have an evaluation, at a minimum, an x-ray by their primary care physician to determine whether or not a referral to a specialist is indicated. But we would never operate on somebody, with totally no pain. I mean, that's very unlikely. But sometimes, we would be able to recommend some non-operative treatment measures that would allow them to get more function and activity out of their diseased joint so that they can do things that they previously hadn't.
Are you aware of any studies analyzing gait analysis and changes in gait analysis that might obviate the need for hip or knee replacement?
That would obviate the need for hip?
That would reduce the need for hip or
No, I mean the only studies that I know in regards to gait analysis is comparing different approaches. So, again, the direct anterior approach has been in vogue, and so they've tried to compare the gait of a patient who undergoes a direct anterior versus a posterior approach. And again, there are some parameters that are more normal in the direct anterior approach than the posterior, but again, they're going to be obviously abnormal compared to healthy controls. But not in terms, I don't quite see the link between a gait analysis and preventing or avoiding a joint replacement surgery.
Apropos of the posterior approach, what exactly are you cutting, and does that affect what, if it fails and you have posterior dislocation or subluxation afterwards,
mm-hmm.
What causes that, and if it does fail, what's the likelihood of recurrence of another dislocation? If a patient doesn't follow their hip precautions,
mm-hmm.
post-surgery and it fails.
So posteriorly, you come through the gluteus maximus, and then in order to get to the hip itself, there are these muscles called the external rotators. You have to reflect the external rotators off the capsule. And now the vast majority of surgeons will try to repair the external rotators to the backside of the femur, and that kind of reattaches the posterior capsule back there. When you have a dislocation and it comes out the back, it's going to rip through the capsule and probably the repair of those external rotators. And so that is going to be a weak area of the hip capsule.
Always.
But that's not to say that they will necessarily have a subsequent dislocation. It depends on if there was some provocative thing that happened that caused the dislocation, and if you're able to avoid those provocative positions, you can avoid a dislocation. Because although they will never repair like they did surgically, scar tissue does form to then cover that defect to some degree.
I'm just curious about the details of how you, particularly me, how you get the proper alignment, how you determine that, and then how, you know, what you actually do when you're in that limited space to get everything going so that it's working.
So there are many ways that we can use to try to line up our implants appropriately. Obviously, you know, we look at the preoperative x-rays to sort of see what the patient's native anatomy is. Again, our goal is to try to drop a plumb line from the hip down through the ankle and go right through the center of the knee. And we want our knee joint to be perpendicular to that. And so there are what are called sort of the standard instrumentation, which will utilize what are called alignment devices. So for the femur, what we do is we stick a rod down the femur, and it will be able to set our cut on our distal femur to try to make that perpendicular. So try to make this cut perpendicular to the ball. And so what I do is I measure on the preoperative x-rays the angle between this, which is called the mechanical axis, and the anatomic axis, and it's usually 5 to 7 degrees. Then I'll put an alignment rod up the femur and set it to 5 or 7 degrees, whatever it is, to kind of make that a perpendicular cut. And that will give me my distal femur cut. For the tibia, we use something called extramedullary alignment. So we don't stick a rod down the knee or down the tibia. We put a jig on the outside that we sort of feel the crest of the tibia or the shin bone, and we align that rod to be parallel with that. And we also, that's in the front plane, and on the side, we look at the slope or the side angle, see this side, and we put the rod and make sure that that is parallel as well. And then we cut off enough bone that we can replace with the metal implant. So there's a minimum thickness you have to cut off to allow for the implant to sit. But it's an imprecise science, and so there is people who use navigation to help with that. That'd be a computer-assisted way of referencing points and making that more precise.
So you're doing that sort of visually. You've got these reference rods, but...
Yep. And then, I mean, it all comes down to whether or not the knee is straight and then the ligaments are balanced. And so if you made your cut aberrantly, there should be some instability of the knee rather than having it nice and straight. In the black?
The procedures that you talked about today, are they specific to UC, or would you find them a standard practice across most medical centers?
So the advances, so I talked about these modular implants, those have been recalled for the vast majority. Gender specific, again, not popular currently, but some surgeons may use them. No one here at UCSF uses them. These custom cutting blocks I used quite often during my subspecialty training. They've kind of fallen out of favor. We don't use them here. Some people in the community may use them. The robot, again, is only sort of used in very niche markets. So I think up in St. Helena, there's a Dr. Kuhn who uses the robot, and there might be a few other people in California. But again, you sort of market yourself as the robot person, and then people who want the robot will go to you. You can't have a robot in every hospital. It's over $1 million. And then we do use all of these advances in bearing surfaces, save for the metal on metal. We don't use metal on metal.
Full hip replacement, where do you kind of draw the line at how active somebody can be after that procedure?
So I feel I'm a patient advocate, and all I can do is provide information for a patient to make their own decision. And so I'm not going to necessarily restrict them from doing anything, but I give them the information with which they can make a decision. Obviously, there are activities that are considered low and there are activities that are considered high impact, and there are very risky activities. So things like, you know, downhill skiing moguls is a very high-risk activity. It's not only high impact, but it has a potential for a catastrophic failure of the implant. And so we'll review all of that. You know, obviously no one who isn't an expert skier is going to go back to that type of downhill skiing, and I would recommend against it. But obviously I'm not there on the slopes, and I'm not on their shoulder like a little angel or something telling them what to do. Everyone's an adult. They'll make their own decision. They just have to realize what the potential ramifications are if a failure happens. And that they're based. What I try to tell people is also that it's sort of like, you know, this is such it can be a very valuable gift, and you treat it as such that, you know, like a fancy car you drove off the lot, you can either take care of it, wash it, bring it in for its tune-ups at prescribed times, or you can dog it and drive it from 0 to 60 at every stoplight, and it's not going to last you as long. So you just have to be sort of conscientious and realize what you're dealing with.
Uh-huh. What about non-impact activities that might expand the range of motion on both knees and hip replacements? Are those things that also should be avoided? Dance, yoga, things like that.
Yeah, so amazingly, there are quite a number of people who partake in yoga these days, which kind of makes me develop palpitations, because you are now putting your hip in a sort of compromised position. No matter which way you go, you know, anterior, lateral, or posterior, if you put your hip in a supra anatomic position or a supraphysiologic position, there's always the potential it can dislocate. We are putting hip replacements with larger balls in there to maximize the stability, but it's never going to be as large as the patient's bony hip, and never going to be as stable as a hip that's never had any operation on it with a full capsule. So I just will recommend that they get back to, you know, certain of their activities and try to modify it to some degree, so they're not doing those extreme poses that, again, would potentially cause a dislocation. And it's all, I think, again, about setting the expectations up front and then educating them on what the ramifications of them doing that that potential move could result in. Okay, thank you very much. Have a good night.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.